Welcome to a new episode of What Really Happened, produced by Dwayne The Rock Johnson, Danny Garcia, Brian Gewirtz, and Cadence 13. Now, our show is only as good as our listeners. Y'all fact check me, provide new insight, give your opinions. And to become a contributor, simply go to jenkspod.com/contributors or call 413-471-2975. Thank you for being a listener and a voice for the podcast. In the last few years, NFL star Aaron Hernandez, musician and rapper Fredo Santana, K-pop star Kim Jong-young, all died at 27 years old. Upon their death, many publications made a point of saying that they had joined a special club. A special club, you may ask. Well, picture perhaps, somewhere in heaven, six musicians. They are at a private club. They're in different parts of a large, elegant living room that offers fine dining, a wall of interesting and wide-ranging literature, and obviously comfortable, expensive sofas and chairs. Near the entrance is Amy Winehouse. She's focused while writing in her notepad, which isn't a surprise. If you watch the documentary Amy, you'll see a scene in which she is inside a studio writing the lyrics for her Back to Black album. Unlike many pop stars of her era, Winehouse, for this critically acclaimed album, co-wrote only four of the songs and herself wrote the rest of the album. This led to five Grammys in 2008, tying the record at the time for most wins by a female artist in one night. In 2011, Winehouse died of alcohol poisoning. She was 27 years old. On the other side of the room is Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones. It's hard to see him because there are a variety of instruments surrounding him. He seems like a mechanic obsessed with his tools. The sitar, saxophone, oboe, and a dulcimer, a folk instrument which few know of and apparently dates back to the early 19th century, where it was used somewhere in the Appalachia Mountains. Bill Wyman, a bass guitarist for the Rolling Stones, once said, "Brian Jones formed the band. He chose the members. He named the band." In 1969, Brian Jones drowned in a swimming pool at his home while under the influence of drugs. He was dead at 27 years old. Quietly working away with a companion in the middle of this lavish room is Jim Morrison. Jim would rather be in a corner or one side of the room like the others, but space is limited. Jim says to his friend, "Hey, listen, I don't know how to write songs. I got these words in my head, and the only way I can remember them is with melodies." Jim finds a quieter side room and sings a cappella. A song like Crystal Ship has a complicated melody, but Jim sings it and his fellow musician says, "Holy shit, wait a minute, F sharp, let's do that." Jim couldn't play a chord on any instrument, but he had this orchestra in his head. Morrison is considered one of the greatest singers in rock, recorded six studio albums with his band The Doors, and is well known for his poetry. Morrison's death was likely from congestive heart failure while in a bathtub. Some have disputed this for different reasons, including there was no autopsy done, and changing stories from those who were around him at the time. When he died in 1971, Rolling Stone's headline didn't mention his music. Instead, it said, "James Douglas Morrison, poet, dead at 27. Unlike anyone else at this private club, Kurt Cobain has wandered up onto the second floor and discovered there was an easel that was intended to be highbrow decoration for the prestigious club. But Cobain didn't consider this, found it to be a waste of a perfectly usable easel, and got to work. His painting is coming together. It will be extraordinary. Kurt was a prolific artist and frontman of Nirvana, considered one of the greatest bands of all time. In 1994, he committed suicide. He was 27 years old. Janis Joplin is hard to see at first. She also has found a corner, but there's a group of people, as it turns out, mentors, surrounding her. Joplin was self-taught, listening and studying Billie Holiday, Otis Redding, and endless others. Joplin admired Bessie Smith so much, she paid for a tombstone to be erected where Smith's unmarked grave had been. Joplin has been called the First Lady and Queen of Rock and Roll. She remains one of the top-selling musicians in U.S. history. In 1970, she died of a heroin overdose. She was 27 years old. He may be alone and not talking to anyone, but Jimi Hendrix is easy to spot. With blue velvet pants and a shiny red top with an oversized, well, perfectly oversized scarf. He isn't surrounded by people like Joplin, but a variety of strings. When Hendrix was about 12 years old, he was with his younger brother, Leon, clearing the garage. Leon remembered, there was a ukulele. It had one string, and that's where Jimmy started. He took it, one string, and when he wanted to change notes, he'd tighten and loosen it, and that's how he started to make music. He said, wow, I get the whole range on one string. It was like Jimmy could just about play anything on one string. He heard music and he learned it. Music has a spirit, and Jimmy felt that spirit. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame describes Hendrix as arguably the greatest instrumentalist in the history of rock music. Rolling Stone has considered him the greatest artist of all time. In 1970, sleeping medication caused an accidental overdose. He was 27 years old. These are the six musicians in the club. All six tragically dead at 27 years old. They have become known as the main members of the 27 Club. In fact, they are part of a larger club of which there is at least 50 members, 50 musicians who have all died at 27 years old. Author Howard Soons has written biographies on Bob Dylan, Amy Winehouse, Charles Bukowski, and is author of the book 27, A History of the 27 Club. Howard cataloged 3,463 people between 1908 and 2012, all achieving notoriety in popular music. He sorted out at what age each person died. The oldest person was 105 years old, and the youngest was 15. 29 individuals died at 25 years old. 30 individuals died at 26 years old. Suddenly, at 27 years old, 50 died. When 28 years old, the number of deaths goes back down to 32. And at 29 years old, 34 deaths. That means the average age of death in the 2 years before 27 and after 27 is just over 30 artists. But at 27 years old, it is nearly twice the number. There have been books and documentaries examining the 27 Club, even studies and academic papers. Many have looked at this and considered the club a curse. There are endless theories why those at 27 years old seem to die at an unusually high rate. I want to know, what really happened? For years, I thought a lot about this 27 Club. I pitched a scripted series to HBO about it years ago and a documentary series to a few production companies only a year or so ago. If you go online, you'll see endless articles about it. When this term, the 27 Club, actually started is unknown. It seems to have taken off by the media and public at large after Kurt Cobain died. It is reported that his mother said, "I told him not to join that stupid club." However, whether she was referring to others who had died at 27 or was referring to potential suicides in the family is unknown. Author Charles R. Cross said, "Hendrix, Morrison, and Joplin all were at least lucky enough to die before the internet, Entertainment Tonight, and People magazine. It wasn't until Kurt Cobain took his own life in 1994 that the idea of the 27 Club arrived in the popular zeitgeist. Cobain's suicide set off a worldwide media onslaught, and Cobain's mother added to the launch of the club concept. Much of the coverage of this club focuses on six of the most famous musicians who died at 27. The six I mentioned earlier, here in order of when they died. Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. When studying all six, there are interesting similarities outside of just their age. One, genius. In his early days, Jim Morrison was certainly known for his good looks. He is what many of us imagine when talking about a rock star. Moody, sexy, scandalous, noted for taking a piss wherever he wanted. As a result, Morrison's brains were sometimes overlooked. From a young age, he loved poetry, history, philosophy, you name it. When he graduated high school, he asked his parents if they'd get him the works of Nietzsche. A genius is considered somebody with an IQ above 140. Morrison is reported to have an IQ level of about 149. Amy Winehouse was a bookworm at a young age, reading literature ranging from Catch-22 to Art Spiegelman's Mouse. Winehouse was a spelling bee champion and in advanced mathematics. This genius, or at very least incredible intellect and creativity, is clear with each member of this club. The second similarity, divorce or traumatic experiences with parents. Amy Winehouse was 9 years old when her parents split. Kurt Cobain was also 9 years old when his parents divorced. He wrote on his bedroom wall, "I hate mom, I hate dad, dad hates mom, mom hates dad." Kurt was ultimately sent to live with his cousins, eventually becoming virtually homeless. When Jimi Hendrix was 15 years old, his mom died behind a bar after collapsing. His dad wouldn't let Jimmy go to the funeral. Jim Morrison's father, an army guy, was always moving, and Jim wrote about wanting to kill his dad and refused to ever see him. In Brian Jones' late teens, his parents were so sick of his lifestyle, he came home one night to find his suitcase in the driveway. Said Pat Andrews, a girlfriend of Brian's and mother to one of his children, "The one thing Brian wanted was for his father, more so than his mother, to say, 'Brian, I'm proud of you.'" The third similarity, a family history of mental health issues. This is tough because to this day, people are afraid of talking about their own mental health issues, and any history of this in one's family still faces the stigma that comes along with it. Family records oftentimes avoid whatever the reality was. According to Howard Soons' book about the 27 Club, there was a history of odd behavior and violent death in Kurt Cobain's extended family. On his mother's side, Kurt's great-grandfather died in a mental hospital of a self-inflicted stab wound. On his father's side, Kurt's great-grandfather, a county sheriff, died in bizarre circumstances. Reaching for a cigarette, he dislodged his pistol, which fell to the ground, went off, and shot him dead. Two of Sheriff Cobain's sons chose suicide by gunshot. Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, and Jimi Hendrix's families all had a history of alcoholism. The fourth similarity, each individual showed signs of severe mental health issues. Several people in Brian Jones' life believed he had bipolar disorder, also known as manic depression. Linda Lawrence, who had a child with Brian, said, "The parents thought he was just a bad child. He was a sick human being that needed comfort and love." While in high school, Amy Winehouse was asking her mother, who was a pharmacist, why she felt depressed. Winehouse began taking medication. Later in life, she would take the anti-anxiety medication Librium, a drug Janis Joplin used for similar reasons. Joplin herself once wrote in a letter, "I want to be happy so fucking bad." At 7 years old, Kurt Cobain was considered hyperactive and put on Ritalin. So a quick break here to talk about Ring. Ring is making a difference for millions of people because they do a really impressive job of making neighborhoods safer. They do this by using smart video doorbells and cameras. In an incredibly simple way, Ring helps you stay connected to your home anywhere in the world. I'm able, which still amazes me, to use my phone to see what's going on at all times. If there's a package delivery or a surprise visitor, I get an alert and I get it from my phone. I can talk to them. "Yo, what's up, criminal? What are you looking to get? My neighbor actually has some pretty good stuff." You can also see the criminal or whomever in HD. So if you're like me and you want to edit a video of them snooping around to put on YouTube, you totally can. But more seriously, outside of my incredible jokes, Ring helps you stay connected to your home anywhere in the world. And as a listener, you have a special offer on a Ring starter kit available right now. With a video doorbell and motion-activated floodlight cam, the starter kit has everything you need to start building a ring of security around your home. Just go to ring.com/WRH. That's ring.com/WRH. The fifth similarity, drugs and alcohol. Kurt Cobain and Janis Joplin were addicted to heroin. Hendrix used LSD, cocaine, and amphetamines. Morrison used LSD, mescaline, amphetamines, and many believe died of an accidental heroin overdose. All drank to excess, and all smoked a lot of weed. I spoke with Charles R. Cross, author of the New York Times best-selling book Heavier Than Heaven, the definitive 2001 biography of Kurt Cobain. He also wrote Room Full of Mirrors, a biography on Jimi Hendrix. Cross is one of the top music journalists in the world. He pointed out that it's important to not get lost in certain narratives and remember the nuance and layers in people's lives, not to mention the facts.
Many people talk about Jimi Hendrix and they talk about his life as if it is the life of a drug addict. I think that's really overstating it, because I think his accessibility and the availability of any of these drugs, and in fact, his ability to pay for them, really only would have even come up in the last year and a half of his life.
To Charles's point, I don't want to make it seem like these musicians' lives are somehow exactly the same. We are talking about unique artists, but there is without a doubt similarities. The sixth similarity that I want to bring up: all six seem to have felt trapped for significant portions of their lives. And it certainly sucks to be trapped. Imagine that feeling, but being an artist when your entire livelihood centers around expression. Kurt Cobain chronicled this feeling throughout his childhood in a small town 100 miles southwest of Seattle. Hendrix felt trapped as his family moved frequently also around the Seattle area. Joplin hated her high school so much, she'd go on to say, "They laughed me out of class, out of town, and out of state." When Jimi Hendrix finally could leave home, he desperately wanted to play music, but instead felt forced to join the army. He'd send letters to his father pleading for him to send over his guitar. Like other musicians, when Hendrix did reach fame, he felt audiences trapping him to only performing the songs they had come to love. For Jimi, there was also race. Charles R. Cross added,
"You know, Jimi just simply could not be accepted in African-American radio. Black stations in America would not play him. And he felt to some degree betrayed by that. At the same time, he was trapped within a worldwide rock culture, and everybody wanted to hear Purple Haze and to hear him squeal on the electric guitar. Jimi wasn't as interested in that."
Last and most important, all six were extremely talented.
I think what was amazing about Jimi for his self-awareness is that music was a way for him to express himself emotionally. He wasn't a big talker. He wasn't somebody who sat down and said, "Hey, I've got a lot going on. Listen to me talk about this." He wasn't very analytical about himself. And yet at the same time, once you put a guitar in his hand, he was able to then use music to kind of create this picture of his emotion. Jimi said that he saw music as colors. I truly think he was a musical genius. And like some of the great classical composers, he was in some ways touched by what he was able to create, what he was able to actually do with this instrument. You know, he was smarter than people want to remember.
There are several other similarities. Each have been reported to have premonitions about their own untimely death. Each had run-ins with the law. Each rose to fame relatively quickly, in some cases extraordinarily quickly. And each had complicated relationships with lovers. Why do these similarities matter? We'll get there, but first it's important to note that in addition to the musicians of the 27 Club, there are also world-renowned artists who have died at 27. Perhaps the most celebrated artist of his generation was Jean-Michel Basquiat, who died at 27. Like many others in this club, he died of a drug overdose, also came from a small town, moved frequently as a child, and showed signs of brilliance at 11 years old. He was fluent in Spanish, French, and English, and could read varied texts in these respective languages. At 13 years old, his mother committed him to a mental institution. At 15 years old, his father left his son on the streets. His rise to fame was quick. At just 24 years old, he appeared on the cover of the New York Times Magazine in a feature titled "New Art, New Money: The Marketing of an American Artist." There are also those who have died or had several mental health issues that appear to have hit a breaking point right around 27 years old. At 26, Britney Spears infamously went to rehab, only to leave a day later and shave her head in front of cameras and thus the world. Heath Ledger died when he was 28. His former wife said, "For as long as I'd known him, he had bouts with insomnia. He had too much energy. His mind was turning, 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 always turning." I'm sort of hesitant to talk about the following, but if we're going to do an episode on this 27 Club, it doesn't take a lot of searching around or reading different books to see why those who believe in supernatural or mystical forces have really latched onto something unexplainable happening at 27. According to certain mystic and Christian theologies, the number 27 is known as the death number. 27 is a lunar symbol of the divine light. Ancient Greek philosophy, in a complex system that used numbers to explain the universe, proposed that 27 represented the process of the soul being reabsorbed into its creator. In the Bible's book of Genesis, God creates humans in the 27th verse. In Buddhist philosophy, 27 is the highest level of spiritual attainment. Accounting for leap years and measuring a year as 365 and a quarter days, there are 31,557,600 seconds in a year. The sum of those numbers is 27. But at what point can we take any number and begin to assign some sort of larger meaning to it? I'm not doubting the importance of astrology or numerology. Right now, for this portion, I'm going from fact-checking to an opinion, but I think there's a massive reach to start drawing correlations between the meanings of 27 and these people dying at 27 years old. With the help of Jonathan Harris and others, I could now talk forever about 27. The diameter of the moon is 0.272 times that of Earth, approximately 27%. The atomic weight of aluminum's only stable isotope is 27. According to Feng Shui, it's good luck to have 27 identical coins at home. In baseball, each team has 27 outs. 27 is a perfect cube, 3 by 3 by 3. The English alphabet contains 26 characters. In the 7th century, European monks invented the white space character between words, and the alphabet now contains 27 characters. I'm 32 years old while writing this, which means I've lived for 286,527 hours. If I was writing this in the Federated States of Micronesia, otherwise no 27. The more I studied numbers and understood the thinking behind supernatural or mystical forces, the more I found myself thinking, well, 27 is certainly a number with a lot of meanings behind it. 27 is the age these individuals died, but just simply pointing this out is about all you can do. Trying to connect the two feels forced. It is forced. It reminds me of the danger of conspiracy theories. You see different things going on and attempt, without facts, to connect them. Let's say you're looking at a piece of paper and there are two dots. One dot represents people dying at 27 and the other dot represents the meanings of the number 27. What I'm doing right now is trying to create a line that connects these two dots, but that's all I'm doing. Trying. Opposed to explanations that we've talked about. Explanations which can cause an early death. Drugs and alcohol, family history of mental health issues, fame, depression, or lack of support. There is a line connecting those dots and the dots of those who have died at 27 years old. If you're interested in exploring this further, there is plenty of reading out there on the meaning behind 27 and any correlations this may have. But not for me. And with all this information, I took a deep breath and went back to the drawing board. So as many of you know, I'm really proud to have some great sponsors this year for our podcast, and that includes an app which I constantly use, like a few times a day use, and that is Calm. Calm has helped me quite a bit. It is the number one app for sleep, meditation, and relaxation. It was even named Apple's 2017 App of the Year. Ooh. If you head to calm.com/WRH, you'll get 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes hundreds of hours of premium programming, including guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, including a brand new meditation each day called the Daily Calm. Sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for adults. I have been using them every night. Calm has over 100 of these soothing tales read by well-known voices to help people unwind and fall into a deep sleep. For a limited time, What Really Happened listeners, that's all of you, can get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/WRH. It includes unlimited access to all of Calm's amazing content. Get started today at calm.com/WRH. That's calm.com/WRH. When doing research for each episode, I always try to remind myself, and I know, mock me if you think this is cheesy, but I try to remind myself of the George Orwell quote, "To see what is in front of one's nose needs a constant struggle." Maybe this happens in your life when you've been preparing for some big event, and then when the special day comes, you've realized, well, what's the address again? What am I wearing? Did I get a gift? An oversight of the most obvious form. A few days ago, I was in a cab home from a psychiatry appointment, of all things, when I thought, all right, our 27 Club episode is coming up. Is there anything I'm missing? One component I began kind of harping on is something that's been on my mind this whole time. And that is the word club in the 27 Club. I was somewhere in the mid-70s in Central Park when I looked up the word. To make a long story short, generally speaking, a club is a good thing to be a part of. A sports club, a book club, a dance club. There's exceptions like anything, but generally speaking, you want to be in a club. The 27 Club sounds like this too, at least for me. It doesn't just sound like something special, but something you'd want to be in. And then I thought, well, maybe it's an ode to these great musicians. If you're going to die at a young age, this is an impressive group to be with. But then it kind of hit me. In all likelihood, the last thing these six members would ever want to be a part of is some sort of club. We're talking about world-class rebels, individual thinkers. These were artists who were the least likely people to ever join any type of club. Far more seriously, and less of me pontificating, is proof that these musicians didn't want to be a part of this club. We know this because they asked, oftentimes pled for help. Help for their depression, mood swings, drug habits, help from their own family and friends. If there is such a 27 Club, they actively were hoping not to be a part of it. If you haven't seen the Academy Award-winning documentary on Amy Winehouse called Amy, I'd highly recommend it. It's directed by Asif Kapadia. While researching this episode of the podcast, and after rewatching the film and going down the rabbit hole of reading more about Asif's process while working on the movie, I came across the below quote. Asif is talking about one of Amy's most well-known songs titled Rehab. Before getting to this quote, for those that don't know, Amy's song was a smash hit. The catchiest part of the song, which you could literally hear people singing along to when walking down the street, was, "They tried to make me go to rehab, and I said no, no, no." I remember exactly where I was when I first heard this song. Chelsea, New York, 23rd Street. I felt weird, I don't know a better word than that, feeling weird when listening. Maybe it's my own struggles with mental health, but Winehouse's song quite clearly is about a person saying they should be getting help, but aren't. However, like most, I can't say this stopped me from listening to the song. Instead, I did so endlessly. Director Asif Kapadia, in the interview I read, said the following about Amy's thoughts. "I don't think she liked the song. It's dark and it's a cry for help. I think she was surprised it became a hit. The trouble was already there, but that's when it really kicked off. That song becomes, I think, the thing that she hated. People wanted her to sing it, and she's singing it with a drink in her hand. It's a cry for help. Every time she says no, she's saying yes." Oh, shit, I thought. In retrospect, I was, or I am, part of the problem. I was one of many celebrating a song about a person badly hurting and pleading for help. So I tracked down Asif on Twitter, asked if he could send me his email. He was kind enough to respond, and I emailed him. I set up a time and called him for an interview. But Asif, in the kindest way possible, said he wouldn't take part. I'm not quoting him, but he was okay with me relaying his thoughts from the notes I took while we spoke. His reason for not wanting to be part of the podcast was simple and left me wondering why I was doing this episode at all. Asif has made it a rule of his not to talk about the quote-unquote 27 Club. He believes this concept has somehow made it seem like it's cool to be an artist and die at 27, when in reality, it's obviously horrific. Any reference to the club, even if well-intentioned, will further the romanticizing of this fake club that is simply put, tragic. I'm not kidding that when he told me this, I was kind of angry at myself. I felt terrible. If you do a simple Google search of the 27 Club, you'll get photos that don't show the reality of each musician's death at 27. Instead, you see cartoons or paintings of the six musicians hanging out in heaven, or talking over a card game, or seated as if at the Last Supper. You see photos of them like they're in the Brady Bunch, smiling, smoking, or playing music, being part of a club. In essence, a celebration. Exactly like how I started this episode. Chill music, the group hanging out, focused on artwork. I now really was part of the problem. I thought of forgetting about this episode and doing something else. I want to take a quick break to thank one of our great partners who really make this podcast possible. As many of you know, I spend most of my time working. I don't really like to do much else. Reading, writing, recording, repeat. So what happens when this is the case? You don't really get furniture. I lived 2 years, this is true, I lived 2 years in an apartment once with only a mattress, no fridge, no rug, no girlfriend. Anyway, my current place, well, something wildly unexpected happened. Now, there's no girlfriend, but I got in touch with the folks at Article. Article has beautifully designed modern furniture and that Scandinavian simplicity, which I happen to be a fan of. I got this new sweet high table desk, not too much. It's just tasteful, and it's all online. No showrooms, no salespeople, just savings. And Article is offering our listeners $50 off their first purchase of $100 or more. To claim, visit article.com/WRH, as in what really happened. That's all it takes. Go to article.com/WRH, and the discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/WRH to get $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. I thought of forgetting about this episode and doing something else. But first, I wanted to spend a bit more time going through my research. I came across the work of Diana Theodora Kenny. Dr. Kenny has a degree in, well, pretty much everything. She's primarily a psychologist and researcher, as well as professor at the University of Sydney. Dr. Kenny is the author of over 200 publications, including 7 books. She was curious about this 27 Club and did her own study with a few colleagues. Dr. Kenny used over 200 sources and studied over 11,000 pop musicians from 1950 to 2014. Her findings? Well, if anything, perhaps there should be a 56 Club. Eddie Rabbit, Tammy Wynette, Mimi Farina, Johnny Ramone, Chris Ledoux, Vandy Smokey Hampton, and Charles Baby Tate all died at 56. In terms of that 27-year-old bump, according to Dr. Kenny's study, 1.2% of the over 11,000 musicians in her study died at 26 years old. 1.4% died at 28, and 1.3% died at 27. So again, 1.2% at 26 years old, 1.4% at 28 years old, and 1.3% at 27 years old. Different studies on this have had different outcomes, but I do believe that the more focused and the more precise the study, the results are that 27 isn't really all that different. Even Howard Soons would go on to explain the limits of his own study. So opposed to moving forward, I took another step back and looked at the years the main six had died. Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison all died between 1969 and 1971. That's 4 of these 6 members dying over the course of 2 years. In fact, Hendrix and Joplin died within 2 weeks of each other. So what was happening during that time period? Singers like Frank Sinatra and Tom Jones were at the peak of their careers during the 1960s and sold millions of records. It was the second half of the decade which saw the emergence of rock music, including psychedelic rock. Michael Hicks, author of 60s Rock, Garage, Psychedelic, and Other Satisfactions, defines the genre as one which exculpates and enhances the mind-altering experiences of psychedelic drugs, most notably LSD. This music was personal and introspective. For one of the first times in pop culture history, the masses were talking about suffering and pain. Musicians were exploring their subconscious more and using drugs to do so. Musicians and record companies saw that the drug culture sold. People, particularly young people, loved it. It was celebrated. There was the human being during the winter of 67, and that summer was the summer of love. And it all reached historic heights during the 1969 Woodstock Festival. With that in mind, it's not so hard to believe that during this time, four of the most famous rock and roll musicians died in their late 20s while enormously popular. It wasn't until 20 years later that this concept of a 27 club came up again. This was in 1994 when Cobain committed suicide. Kurt had a history of mental health issues, and so did his family. He had attempted suicide before turning 27. It seems to me it was a convenient and easy way to put him, a unique and brilliant artist, into this 27 club, this constructed group. Of course, the term found itself again on the headlines of papers around the world when Amy Winehouse died about 15 years later. What is perhaps less exciting to talk about and examine is why musicians and artists are dying at this relatively young age and if there's anything to be done. As it turns out, I've learned there is research that shows how our perception of the late 20s is misunderstood, or at least was misunderstood by me until the last 18 months. While I thought of a 27-year-old as a fully formed adult, research shows otherwise. With the help of Heather Sherman, I reached out to Dr. Roger McIntyre, a professor of psychiatry and pharmacology at the University of Toronto and head of the Mood Disorders Psychopharmacology Unit at the University Health Network.
The old notion that we had in neuroscience or brain science for a long time was that, you know, after you go through your adolescence and reach early adulthood, the brain that you have is the brain that you're stuck with. And we've moved away from that very outdated, anachronistic notion to a more comprehensive, coherent, and more scientifically informed notion. But the brain really is this plastic, mutable, changeable organism.
Dr. McIntyre added,
but even in your mid-20s, for example, early 30s, there's still the capacity to generate from early progenitor or early sort of undifferentiated cells, brain cells. And these brain cells are not just sort of appearing, but they're also functioning. So these are new, mature adult brain cells that have a functional relevance to people.
When it comes to drugs, weed has a bigger effect on our minds than previously thought.
We know that cannabis exposure, specifically THC-9, in a developing brain can be highly toxic, can induce psychosis in those who are at risk, particularly in the younger brain, that is people under the age of 25, certainly under the age of 20.
What Dr. Kenny did find in her research was that pop artists' lifespans were up to 25 years shorter than the average American. Accidental death rates were between 5 and 10 times greater. Suicide rates were between 2 and 7 times greater. And homicide rates were up to 8 times greater than the U.S. population. After publishing her study, Dr. Kenny concluded, "This is clear evidence that all is not well in pop music land. Why is this so? The pop music scene fails to provide boundaries and to model and expect acceptable behavior. It actually does the reverse. It valorizes outrageous behavior and the acting out of aggressive, sexual, and destructive impulses that most of us dare only live out in fantasy. The music industry needs to consider these findings to discover ways of recognizing and assisting young musicians in distress. At the very least, those who make their livings from these young people need to learn to recognize early signs of emotional distress, crisis, depression, and suicidality, and to put some support systems in place to provide the necessary assistance and care." In regards to Jimmy's death and those around him, Charles R. Cross said,
"He didn't have one person kind of checking up on him.
In the end, both Jimmy's managers are dead now. There's no, really way to say it other than to some degree, Jimmy's death ends up being the responsibility of his managers. I think that ultimately ends up being a lot of the story of rock history. Many times these stars are using drugs. The managers are well aware of it. And in Jimmy's case, in all likelihood, one of his managers, Michael Jeffries, was probably supplying drugs to Jimmy at times. That gave him a level of control. Jimmy's death, in some ways, we blame on the manager. If you're a rock manager, the worst thing you can do is let your client die. And sadly, that ends up being the case in more than a few of these rock lives.
Ultimately, I've discovered that there isn't any club. What you do have is six artists who were faced with a great deal of success and turmoil in a very short period of time. They also faced fame, drug and alcohol addiction, money, or at least people with money, a lack of foundational support, the trappings that can come with being an artist, and all of this while their brains were still forming. When you look at this infamous club, four of these main members died over the course of only 2 years during a time period in which drugs were rampant and largely celebrated. Unlike Asif, who directed the documentary on Amy Winehouse, I clearly opted to talk about the 27 Club. I don't think there is a right approach. There is a larger debate to be had about whether or not addressing this club helps or hurt the cause of addressing the larger problem. It only takes a very quick search to see that Rolling Stone magazine, BBC, The Washington Post, and endless other respectable news outlets to fairly obscure blogs have written at length about this term and its members, without also mentioning the term's flaws, oftentimes getting lost in some sort of romanticized recounting of those who've passed. For now, I don't think there are enough voices pointing out why this term is in fact offensive. It has nothing to do with a PC culture. It has to do with facts not adding up and being sensitive when we talk about mental health issues and alcoholics or drug addicts. What I think would be a step in the right direction is to bring attention to this. Because to this day, when you hear about a public figure who dies at 27 years old, you'll read headlines that they are joining a club. But that is not what really happened. Next week on What Really Happened. In 1994, the president of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, was discovered by the Secret Service in Washington, D.C. on Pennsylvania Avenue. He was extremely drunk, wearing only underwear, yelling for a cab, and demanding pizza. President Clinton would do his best to help his friend, President Yeltsin, with his drinking problems, but in the decades since, the American and Russian relationship has taken severe turns. That's next week on What Really Happened. Don't forget, go to jenkspod.com to give me feedback, or jenkspod.com/contributors to become a part of the team. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Andrew Jenks.